Your new novel set in Montgomery, Alabama in 1918. What interested you in Alabama as a setting for a novel?
I was on a train on my way across the country, which I like to do a lot, get on the trains. And we pulled into the Montgomery train station. And here is this magnificent but decaying structure. And I just was drawn to it immediately. And for a flash, I saw people in it that didn't belong there. It was funny. It was like one of those visions. And I got back on the train and started making notes for the novel. I knew I had to set the novel at that train station, or at least have that train station figure in the book.
What did you know before about that part of the South?
Not much, really. I'd been in Birmingham and liked it, but I'd never spent much time at all in Alabama. I'm really sort of a coastal person, spent most of my time in Virginia and that part of the South, or Charleston. But this was the first time I was ever in what's called the Delta South. And Montgomery is a strange and wonderful town in that Alabama is really a poor state and not a cotton state, you know, not the big plantation state that maybe Mississippi was. But Montgomery sits on the tip of a little triangle of rich earth so that it could be a cotton-producing area, just that tiny little bit. So Montgomery's where they all came in and where they did their training and stuff, and there's a river there. Well, everybody in Montgomery just had these wild visions that they were going to be the ultimate Southerners. So they were. They were kind of like converted Catholics. But the bulk of Alabama has nothing to do with that kind of plantation mentality. The bulk of Alabama is sort of hardscrabble whites. So that was fun for me to learn and get into, the fact that Montgomery was always an illusory city, in a sense.
So how did you scope it out? Did you spend time there, travel around?
Did a lot of research in the library first, which is where I have to start every book I do, and then spend a little time there, but not much. I mean, I'm very furtive when I'm doing research because I never want people to know I'm doing it. That's the surest way not to get the material you need. And I had some people who lived in Alabama that would send me stuff from time to time, and it took about a year.
Well, two of the main characters in it are high-class whores. Yes?
Well, they think they're high-class.
They're high-class. Okay. What kind of homework did you have to do to find out what the life of a prostitute in Alabama was?
Well, first I should give you their names, Blue Rhonda Latreck and Banana Mae Parker. And I will leave your listeners ever curious as to how much personal research I did. But I did find some aging women in their 70s and 80s, who had once been prostitutes, not necessarily in Alabama. And I questioned them as best I could because, of course, a lot of these ladies don't want to particularly reveal their past, so I had to be a little bit subtle about it. But when I did get people to speak to me directly, it usually was, I think part of it was they were recalling their own youth, so it perhaps seemed more golden than it really was. And at that time, there wasn't the drug abuse that there is now, and there weren't necessarily the connection to pimps. Maybe some people had them, but you could kind of operate without them then. Or at least that's what they told me, and I took them at their word. It was just a little different. And also people knew one another. There wasn't the lone streetwalker, unbeknownst to anybody, trying to support a habit that we've got now. And there were houses. People took care of one another. There were really true big houses of prostitution. And all that's kind of fallen by the wayside. And that was very interesting for me to find out that there literally is a history of prostitution and that it has changed along with our country. Because like most women who have never been part of that life, I was totally ignorant.
You know what I would have really wanted to know about is what they did for like protection against venereal diseases.
Well, there wasn't anything they could do. In those days, if you got syphilis, they gave you mercury treatments where they could keep you from transmitting the disease, but it would ever be in your system. So that was hopeless. And in terms of birth control, well, of course, it was pretty primitive. You counted your days. Some women used sponges and stuff like that, which sometimes would work, and as we know, many times did not. But the major concern was more children than venereal disease, or at least that's what they expressed to me.
Mm-hmm. Part of the novel is really about the kind of class stereotypes people have one another and the class boundaries that exist in a social structure like the South at that time. Did you have something in your mind that made you want to explore that in a novel?
Well, I live in Virginia. I mean, I'm not in the Delta South, but I am in the South. And the class structures are quite clearly defined. Now, I happen to think they're clearly defined in Philadelphia, too. I mean, I think there's an upper crust that marries amid one another and doesn't really mix with the hoi polloi. And they don't even mix with the middle class particularly. They are unto themselves. Then there's the middle class, which is the world of media. They're the producers and the directors of media, and they're only telling their own stories. So the middle class lives in this sort of never-never land where they think everyone is like themselves. And the upper class has such total contempt for them. And the middle class never sees the upper class, never gets a foot inside those clubs, but, you know, gets rich, buys a Mercedes, and think that they've made it. Well, they'll never make it. They'll never be a Dinwiddie or a Cadwalder or a Kleiser or a Mallory or any of the great names. You'll never get into those social circles. And then, of course, there are the poor, which everybody pretends don't exist, and you try to skirt the slums as you can. So I think we still have a very lively class structure that we're just unwilling to address.
And that's something you wanted to address in your book?
Well, I think I get at it through the back door in all of my books, because what fascinates me as a writer is the way in which people live their separate lives and then collide with people from different backgrounds, which as much as you try to keep yourself separate from others, unless you're truly, truly rich, you can't. Inevitably, you're going to run into people different from yourself, and I say hallelujah, because that's what I want.
Well, as an increasingly successful writer who's starting to work with movie people and TV people, what kind of class structure do you see in that world of media, of television and movies?
There's only one class structure, and that's ruthless competition. You're only as good as your last movie. All that stuff's really true. Unless you're in a position of someone like a Fred Astaire, you've been around so long and the work that you've done is so great, you don't have to do anything for the rest of your life. It's interesting in the media, anybody who has talent has a shot at it. So it doesn't matter where you come from. If you've got the talent, you've got some kind of chance. You may have to starve for 10 years. But there's a rough, and I emphasize very rough, equality in show business. I think that's why so many people are attracted to it.
Is it equality for women now also, do you think? And for
not for actresses. Never for actresses. I mean, those are the continual victims of the industry. Actors are, too. But it's not quite, I mean, there are still more good roles for men than there are for women on television and film. But for a writer, they don't care what you are as long as you can produce.
Do people wear their status in any way once they've arrived?
Out there? Oh, God, yes. They put all their goods in the front window. It's truly embarrassing to someone who comes from a place where money should speak quietly, if it speaks at all. I mean, they get these little Mercedes 450 SLs. They buy Rolls-Royce Silver Shadows. They get expensive watches and suntans. I mean, it's hysterical to watch somebody make it out there because they all behave so badly. I mean, not necessarily badly as people, but they do things that are embarrassing to somebody, let's say, who's a Southerner. And then they get over it. If they're successful long enough, they get over it and they don't have to jam their money down your throat. And that's one of the things I love most about Norman Lear. You'd never know the guy has a dime, the least, not concerned with it at all. Only concerned with his work.
Well, what do you do when someone's being really ostentatious and you're not impressed?
Well, it's not my problem. It's their problem. I don't care how much money somebody makes. I never did. So if you're going to dazzle some diamond in front of me, I might admire it. I mean, I'm certainly, I've always been wildly aesthetic in my tastes, but it doesn't make you a better person in my book.
There was a quote from you that sent out in some of your publicity, and I really didn't know what to make of it. It runs something like, on good days I'm concerned about social justice, and on bad days it's diamonds and furs.
Yeah, that's just me cutting a shine, as we say down south. Just having a good time, and I think it's true. On my good days I care about the world, on my bad days I care only about myself.
Are your tastes changing now that you're...
No, I've always had good taste. I just haven't had the money to pursue it. My mother has fabulous taste. I mean, she always sewed for herself, and we lived on less than $2,000 a year, our whole family. I mean, you're talking about poor people now. My mother never set foot out that house, but that her hat, shoes, purse, and gloves matched, and that she had a dress she'd sewn for herself, and she looked terrific. As a little girl, I remember going into town with my mother and being so proud of her because people stopped to look at her. And now, she just turned 77 on March 6th, they still stop to look at her. She's never stopped sewing. She's got an old, I think it's white, it's called white sewing machine with a treadle. She still makes her own clothes. She looks fabulous.
Hmm. Because of your success with Ruby Fruit Jungle, and because everybody knows you're gay, I think people expect you to be writing novels about gay people. And if you go through your new novel, the main character is, it's not a book about a lesbian. Was that an intentional thing to not write a book about a lesbian?
No, I'm not self-conscious enough to be intentional. I mean, I have novels the way people have babies, which is I just have them. And my responsibility is to tell the truth, which means whatever story comes to me or I have heard from my family in some fashion, that's the story I have to tell. I'm not here to be a propagandist. That's for people without talent.
Okay. My understanding is that it's really hard to be out in Hollywood.
Yes.
But it might be different if you were out before you got to Hollywood.
No, it's still hard. I mean, I encountered some difficulties, not as many as 5 years ago. And people are very fair there. I said, if you can do the job for them, that's basically what they care about. Now, I'm a writer. I'm not an actress. It's different. It's always different for the people in front of the camera, and it's vicious for the people in front of the camera. I can't emphasize how vicious it is. And John Belushi will not be the only drug death we're going to have in the next couple years. I mean, people are desperately unhappy because they're continually pushed around in a way that it's so hard for people outside the industry to realize. They see a glamorous life, and it's not glamorous at all. It's rugged and it's brutal, and your ego is assaulted daily. And a lot of people just can't take it, and they fill themselves up with a substance that makes them feel temporarily better. But I had some difficulties, not that many. But, I mean, I don't walk into a room with a neon sign. I just don't lie. That's what makes me different from most people. I mean, at some point, if we're having a conversation and somebody asks me who I'm going out with, I'll tell them. You know, and if they have a big reaction to it, that's their problem. It's not my problem. The only thing I'm here to do is to be who I am. I often think of Martin Buber, who wrote a book called I, Thou. And he said when he dies and he goes before the Lord is not going to say, why were you not more like Jesus Christ, but why were you not more like Martin Buber? So it's my responsibility to be more like Rita Mae Brown, and that includes being as honest as I can about my life.
Have you met a lot of people who can't afford to be that honest?
Well, they say they can't afford to be that honest, but if they banded together, of course they could. I mean, the horrendous thing about gay people is that they can lie, and they daily diminish their integrity. I think it's one of the reasons why there's so much self-destructiveness among that group of people. If every person who ever loved another individual of their own sex had a blue dot in the middle of their forehead, I guarantee you it would be the end of this problem. It would just be over. But because these people can lie about it, they stab people like me in the back. Sure, I mean, I take more heat from closet homosexuals than I ever take from the Christian right wing. And let me tell you, I take heat from the Christian right wing. I mean, they're up in arms. I get their hate mail. I get all that stuff, which amazes me. Christian and hate. It just doesn't connect in my mind at all.
What do you get?
You know, like, you're sick, you're awful, you should be killed. I mean, this kind of real drivel. And then embrace Jesus Christ at the end of the letters. I mean, obviously, and the last Christian died on the cross when it comes to those people, because they're sure not Christians in my book. But it's kind of amazing. I have no tolerance with homosexual fear. I really don't. I think homosexuals enlarge it so as to make themselves more important in their own lives. I really do. And yes, some people are going to lose jobs. But if we did it together, let's say July 4th, 1985, everybody comes out. Or everybody who thinks, hey, let's just shut up and let people live their own lives, wears a purple armband. That's the end of it, because we all share the risk. But as long as people stay quiet and only one by one we emerge, those one by one can get picked off.
Well, I think that it's always considered to be a really unprofitable thing for an actor or an actress to come out, because then all their heterosexual roles will be colored by the fact that they're not really heterosexual, and all the people who fantasize about them when they go to the movies, all the straight people who do, will be kind of out of the running. But do you think that the problem is more with the viewers, or more the fear of
No.
the people in the industry?
Nope. It's in the industry. I think the American public is incredibly kind and extremely tolerant. I mean, yes, there's nuts on the right and there's nuts on the left. But the great bulk of the American public, God bless them, are so good-hearted. They don't care. And if you're an actor, you're supposed to act. We don't care what your private life is. Get up there and do the job. Dazzle us with your talent. Who you go home to is your own darn business.
Rita Mae Brown is my guest, if you're just joining us. You worked on the Norman Lear special, I Love Liberty, which was on just a few weeks ago. Did you get a chance to watch it?
Sure, I was there for the whole thing from beginning to end. We started writing it at the end of November, and then we taped it to February 22nd. We thought it would be live, then ABC moved it. So I was there from beginning to end, and at the same time trying to get ready for the Southern Discomfort Tour. I mean, we worked from 7 a.m. in the morning, often until 12 o'clock at night, through the weekends. I mean, this was the most intense work experience I've ever had, and I'm very grateful for it. Norman gave me the chance of a lifetime. And it was sink or swim. I walked in. I'd never written a TV show. I'd done screenplays. But television isn't film, and they're very different. And, I mean, I really had to learn to swim, literally.
What did you have to learn right away?
I had to learn to change my timing. I had to learn to be reductive because you're basically writing for the sixth grade mentality. I don't mean that to be snotty. I mean, that's what you're given to work with. And you have to cut for commercials. You have to think about where the commercial comes. And you also have to remember that you have a very tiny screen so that you can't have expansive movement. So it's all different. And it was real. I mean, the first month, it was touch and go. I mean, I really suffered that first month.
Did someone say we're writing to a sixth grade mentality?
Or? No. But you clearly can see it in the dialogue. And I know the kind of dialogue I can do in a novel or in a feature film. And you learn very quickly you can't do that. You've got to change it around and scale it down.
So for our listeners who didn't see it, do you want to describe the premise of the show?
The premise of the show is to celebrate the First Amendment, which was wonderfully done with songs and with little historical vignettes taken from like 1782 or 1865, wherever it came in, to show us that we have freedom of speech in this country, freedom of worship, or freedom not to worship. The right to assemble peaceably and the right to go to your government and say, hey, you didn't do such a hot job. And that's what it's all about. That's what being an American is all about. And when we started doing the show, Jerry Falwell figured he'd get a lot of cheap publicity out of it. So he screamed and hollered and said that Norman was doing this against the moral majority. Well, I'm telling you, when standing up for the Bill of Rights is against the moral majority, then the moral majority just aren't such hot Americans, are they? And that's all the show was. It was the First Amendment. And so this guy got tons of free PR off of it, squealing and hollering. And then the show went on the air, and I think anybody with an IQ over 90 said, hey, this is terrific. This isn't against anybody. This is for America.
Now, I saw a few minutes of it on TV. I guess one of the things that bothered me is that it defined patriotism as being like the singing of the patriotic songs and waving the flag, at a time when I thought maybe we need to expand the meaning of patriotism to the singing of other songs as well and
well, that was
other
in
gestures.
There. I mean, there was a point toward the end where there was a religious debate between a young preacher. It was Christopher Reeve, Superman, and Timothy. I can't think of the guy's name.
Tony Geary?
Yeah, I never watched daytime TV. In which some of that – no, actually, I got it wrong. It was a piece about a guy in a park in the 1930s. Kaminsky, who's talking about his rights, and a young man stands up and says, you're full of bull, the government can take your rights away. And initially, there was even more of that in there. It wasn't Norman that got a little soft, it was ABC. So we were left with some of it, but not nearly as much of it as we wanted, which is to say, hey, you know, there's been a lot of trouble in this country. There always has been, and there always will be.
So now that you have that credit now, can you write more TV, and would you want to?
Yes, I would. Most writers are very disdainful of television, and I found myself quite excited by it, although realizing it's a very fast burnout medium. You have to guard yourself a lot. And I've got a chance to do a television show in San Francisco with another writer called Armistead Maupin, who did a series of books called Tales of the City. And we're going to, I mean, I don't know if it'll work, but we're going to try to do this show, which is in a sense what Dorothy Kilgallen and her husband used to do on the radio, which is this very sophisticated, frothy show about what happened in the city. And we'll be able to do it, we hope, once a week. And it'll be the two of us, and sometimes we'll go out with cameras, so we'll be able to tape stuff, and the rest of the time we'll be inside. And it's just fun, spontaneous fun, the way television used to be, when there was Steve Allen and Jack Parr, not this kind of canned crud that you've got now. And we may not get very far with it, but we really want to try.
How do you like working collaboratively?
Well, I think as a novelist, I would rather work alone. But if it's something like this where you're really much more defining the shape of it than just being the hired help, that's fun. And I've worked collaboratively before, so I know the process. And it's okay. Something's lost, but something's gained, which is namely speed.
Yeah, you know, I just want to get back to something we were talking about coming out in Hollywood and what that's like. I wonder if you've seen any of the movies with gay characters in it.
Yeah, I did.
What do you think of them? Let's see. There's Making Love, Personal Best, Taxi Zimclo, which hasn't shown here.
I haven't seen that. In fact, it was funny. I saw both of those movies with Gore Vidal, Norman and Francis Lear, Carl and Estelle Reiner, Joan Didion and John Gregory Dunn, and David Picker, who used to be head of United Artists, and Nessa Hyam, who's a director. And then there were some other people there that I didn't even get to meet, so I'm in this room full of people screening these movies. And Making Love was, I thought, a really nice story, but I didn't like the conceit of the actor looking directly into the camera and telling us their emotions. I thought, gee, don't do that. I want to see it between them. I don't want to hear about it as a bystander. So that was my only quibble. And Personal Best, I thought, was really two movies. I mean, the message I got is if I want to be a lesbian, I should buy colored underpants and run on the beach. It didn't connect with me at all, not in the least. And the sports stuff was boring, too, because you knew the outcome before you started. So there was no tension for me in that movie. And if a movie has no tension, I tend to fall asleep very quickly.
Do you think that those movies will make it any easier for other screenwriters who want to write movies with gay characters in it?
The only way to tell is if they make a profit, because that's all they care about back there.
Have you started reading Variety now to see what does make a profit?
Oh, I've been reading that for years.
Yeah.
I mean, actually, since about 77. You read Variety and The Hollywood Reporter, and you just go quickly turn to the section where there's the box office, and you see who's making what.
What is it? Does that affect what you're going to write about or anything?
Not me. I'll never write for the buck. If I make money, terrific, hooray. But I'm not. You can't hire my brain that way.
What did you think of the press coverage of the end of your relationship with Martina Navratilova? It got considerable coverage in Philadelphia.
Well, I'm not responsible for that. I did not give the press conference in Dallas. That was Martina and Nancy Lieberman, which shocked me. Tremendously. I mean, she left me in April, so I don't know why she gave a press conference in August, because nobody knew anything. And the minute that they did, I mean, then the lid was blown off the can. So the media did what it always does, which is if you give them permission to burrow into your life, they will. And she blew it off, in a sense. And then it was up for grabs, and everybody was after the story. There wasn't anything I could do at that point. There was just nothing I could do.
So you don't know why she did it then?
I have a lot of ideas, and obviously if I spoke them, I'd be sued for libel.
Did it affect her career?
Hell no. I mean, when we were together, she made more money than anybody else on the tour, but she didn't win Wimbledon or the U.S. Open. And, I spent 2 years with her and loved her deeply. So I can't say one rotten thing about her. I just wish she had never done that, because it was a big mistake, and it was also bad form.
Yeah.
It was just bad form.
How is that affecting the interest in your new novel? Does that kind of people page type interest, and that's where a lot of the coverage was, carry over to interest in a novelist's new work?
I have no idea, because I have such a strong following. So I don't know if I added people because of it or if I didn't. I mean, I know that Southern Discomfort's number 2 in Chicago. It's sold out in Denver and San Francisco. It's going great guns. It's back for second printing. And I don't read my reviews, but my editor was quick to tell me I got a very good one in the New York Times. Is it that? Or is it just publicity? I don't know. The thing I do know about publicity, and this is just getting older as well as being in the business, is people remember it for 2 minutes and they forget it. And they're on to the next thing. So there's a point where you can't really believe publicity, whether it's good publicity for you or bad publicity, because you know it goes out with next morning's trash.
Well, since your novel's set in Alabama, how do you think it's going to play in the South?
Well, the South never buys as many books as the rest of the country. It's much more poor. It's much more rural. But I don't see that it will. I mean, I think it'll do well because it's Southern and because most people down there will recognize those characters immediately.
Okay. Thanks a lot for talking with us.
Thank you.